This edition of The Entrepreneurs was first broadcast on the 10th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. The Entrepreneurs, in association with Pictet. Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly business show. I'm Sophie Grove. To start off this week's episode, we chat with an entrepreneur who's revolutionised the process of self-publishing.
The big question for us was, could we make money on a book of one copy? We thought, if we could figure out how to make money on a book of one, then we could open up publishing to everyone in the world.
We speak with a group of investors intent on providing finance for solar energy projects at the right price.
The idea is that lots of micro-investors can put money in to contribute towards part of a solar investment, which is, like the name of the company suggests, one solar tile at a time.
We meet the founder of a new British menswear label.
Every little step builds, you know, one step further towards your vision. As those things build up, you gradually start to see the picture of your vision developing. And then it just takes, you know, it's the grunt work to then get it out there to, you know, to realise and open on that first day.
We'll also speak with an Austrian boatmaker who's gone green, chat with venture capitalist Tony Chan about his new book, Hearts, Smarts, Guts and Luck, review a Finnish wristwatch company with military heritage, and give the venerable kitchenware outfit Le Creuset a branding overhaul with our friends at Wink Creative. All that and much more coming up this week on The Entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 52 of The Entrepreneurs. I'm Sophie Grove. We start the show with a success story of self-publishing. In 2005, when Eileen Gittins launched her company Blurb, she was intent on filling a gaping hole in the market. She wanted to allow consumers to quickly, simply, and cheaply publish physical books. The publishing world was notoriously entrenched in its ways, and her prospects looked grim. Yet only 5 years later, Blurb was named the fastest growing media company in the United States. The story of how this happened is a fascinating one. Eileen popped by the studio to tell us more.
At the time, ebooks weren't quite there yet, so it was about print. So the big question for us was, could we make money on a book of one copy? How would we do that? Seriously. Because if publishing was all about, no, you need to sell through 30,000 to make it economic, we thought, if we could figure out how to make money on a book of one, then we could open up publishing to everyone in the world who had something to say or who had some content that they wanted to publish for whatever reason, whether for personal or just sharing or to sell or for promotional reasons.
And when you first approached printers with that idea, did they laugh at you?
Yes. So? Well, first the VCs laughed at me because they thought I was crazy, honestly, because this was at a time when WordPress, blogs, Wikipedia, Flickr, things were all going online. And I was approaching them in 2005 to get the company financed. And I was saying, well, I've got this great idea. How about we take all of this digital content and we take it back out analog and we print physical books? What do you think? And they all, I mean, I knew a lot of VCs because I'd been CEO of a couple of other companies. So they took my meeting. But usually those meetings ended with, great to see you, Eileen. Let's have lunch sometime. Good luck. And that was that. And so finally what ended up happening was I went back to a couple of VCs that I knew well. And they gave me, you know, $2 million to start the business because they thought, you know, I don't think they knew exactly what it was going to become, but they thought this business of disrupting what was a $70 billion industry worldwide, that was interesting. And I think they just, as much as anything, were betting on me as they were that I had all the answers.
And clearly they were onto something because 5 years later, you were the fastest growing media company in the United States.
It's true. This last year, we delivered almost 2 million books to 72 countries on 5 continents in 5 years' time. We launched in mid-2006, and every year we have been growing, growing, growing to the point where now we're approaching doing $100 million of revenue, somewhere close to that this year. So we've been growing by leaps and bounds, and of course, this last week, we've not only launched an ebook for the iPad, but we've just launched tools for everybody to be able to make a rich media ebook. So you can now add video and voice and live links in your ebooks.
So how did you convince printers to take on these one jobs?
Yep. That turns out to be both the easiest part and the most difficult part. The easy part, honestly, was we were approaching them at a time, this is, remember, 2005, when a lot of their print business was going away. We found a printer in Seattle, Washington, who had been doing a lot of the technical manuals for Microsoft. Well, Microsoft was taking those all onto CD-ROM, so there was no more printing. So these guys had huge capacity sitting around with print devices, print engines, and people that they wanted to continue to employ. So here was my pitch to them. Okay, you ready? So we will write to your API. We will send you the cleanest work you've ever seen. It will all be pre-press enabled. We will print one size book. You tell us how you want the files delivered. You never have to deal with a customer. The only customer you ever have to deal with is Blurb. And we will bring you all this business. And what do you think? And basically they said, so how many books do you think we could do? And we gave them our forecasts. And I will tell you, we exceeded our forecasts. And the result is, after we started with that first printer, then we got a second one very quickly on the East Coast. And now we have printers all over the world, none of whom are owned by us, by the way. Interesting. We are a web company. We're a technology company. We don't actually do any of the printing ourselves. So the easy part was getting them to sign up to, that sounds great. The difficult part was, it turns out the hardest part was actually the integration technically, because these guys were all used to shipping out a pallet of books to three customers a day. We needed to send out 3,000 packages to individual people around the world every day. So the actual data integration part and tech, you know, systems integration part turned out to be the hardest thing of all, because they knew how to print books. They just had no idea about e-commerce and how to physically ship 3,000 packages via, you know, the mail or the post a day.
You know, I'm reading here, you had a new book title coming across your server every 1.1 seconds.
Yeah.
So, and what are the advantages of outsourcing the actual printing from a business perspective?
Yep. Because we don't have to buy equipment, and because we now have enough leverage because we're doing volume, we can go to our print partners and develop a new product in 90 days' time. If we owned all of that kit ourselves and had to train up people and buy the paper and all of this, it would take us 9 months, not 90 days. Mm-hmm. So we are now able to develop new products. In fact, we're coming out with a magazine product later this month. We're going to be launching a brand new format for personal magazine creation for people all over the world. That's very exciting. If we were doing that from scratch as the printer ourselves, Christ, that would take us 2 years to get that off the ground.
And what I find also very interesting is that you have a market for the self-publishers who use Blurb. Tell us about the market. What kind of people are selling books?
Yeah. So what we did from the very get-go was said, okay, if we can achieve a level of print quality and really fidelity, color management fidelity, and beautiful materiality, then people like me would flock to our doors. So our first place was go after creative professionals who were really discerning about print quality. Because of that, then, of course, all kinds of companies started to find their way to our door. So Nike and Ralph Lauren and Pixar and Disney and all of these companies for whom, if you can't replicate the logo color of that business, forget about it. It's the price of admission, right? So we started to see all of these businesses come to Blurb. Well, when we saw that, then people who had commercial work that they wanted to sell also found out about us. And pretty soon, instead of just having an e-commerce engine where people could buy their own books, we started to have people say, hang on a minute, I'd love to sell my book at Blurb. Can you enable me to make money on my books? So we said, yes, we'd be delighted to do that. So we opened up our bookstore, and our business model became this on the print side. When you make a book, you have a decision. You can make that book public if you wish at our bookstore at blurb.com, or you can keep it private. If you make it public, you then have the option of choosing whatever price for it over and above the unit price of a single printed copy. So for instance, if your book was £15 or $15, you could sell that book for £20 or $25. And our model is you keep 100% of the markup. So in the £15 to £20 version, we would send you literally £5 every time somebody in the world bought a copy of your book. Last year, we paid out more than $1 million to authors around the world. So it really has started to take off. And now we think with the ebook, the way it works, it's really interesting. For the princely sum of, in the UK, I think it's about £6.50. You can use all of our tools for free. From the same file, you can either output to a print version or an ebook version. You can make both available at blurb.com in the bookstore. And the similar model applies. Every time somebody buys a copy of your ebook, you keep 80%, and Blurb takes 20%. But here's the really wonderful bit. If you want to sell your ebook for free, go ahead. You can sell it for nothing to start making a market for yourself. And then as your market starts to grow, then you can start attaching some commercial value to it. And that's when we participate together in your success.
That was Eileen Gittins, the CEO of Blurb, with our producer, Daniel Giacopelli. Moving now from books to energy. While it makes sense to install renewable energy like wind and solar on an environmental basis, sometimes making the financials line up is a little more difficult. Often, one of the most expensive aspects of solar installation is the cost of finding the finance for what some banks consider a risky investment. But as is often the case with most new business, where there's a challenge, there's often an opportunity. And some willing entrepreneurs are turning their attention onto how to provide finance for solar energy at the right price and to build a business of their own at the same time. Monocle's Jonathan Gifford reports.
An international business like Solar Energy loves a get-together, and at the recent InterSolar trade show in San Francisco, manufacturers and researchers from China, Germany, Japan, India, and as far away as Australia got together to make some deals and to find solutions to help clean energy grow in the US and beyond. And a major hurdle that solar developers keep running into is how to get the banks behind what they think is a great idea and a great investment.
You know, broadly, it's a very big challenge. So, I mean, at this point and where panel prices have gone, the cost of capital is more important than the cost of the modules themselves. And so the U.S. has been structured in such a way very different from Europe, where the tax credit has sort of created a very scarce commodity, which is tax equity.
Christian Hanelt works for a company called Clean Power Finance. They've created a business out of finding those companies that can take advantage of the tax credit on offer for renewable investments in the US and put them in touch with solar developers.
What we do at Clean Power Finance, which is quite unique, is we've really built a platform that serves as a conduit between the capital markets and our installer network, which is anchored by our CPF Tools software program. So we have 40% of the industry in terms of installers that use our software. And so we've got this massive pool of installers that are looking for financing. And so we've built a platform to connect them with the capital markets.
And it's turned into pretty big business. Companies like Google, looking for tax credits and also for a steady and green investment, have put literally hundreds of millions of dollars down that Clean Power Finance can then make available to solar companies who simply need the capital up front. Earlier this year, the company picked up the New Energy Pioneer Award from Bloomberg Clean Energy Finance. But to be honest, that's the top end of town and the big business side of things. Across the San Francisco Bay to Oakland, there's another entrepreneur who's trying to make solar finance available at just $25 a pop. Solar Mosaic is a startup company that's trying to bring the crowdfunding idea to renewable energy. The idea is that lots of micro-investors can put money in to contribute towards part of a solar investment, which is, like the name of the company suggests, one solar tile at a time. Lisa Curtis is the community builder at Solar Mosaic.
They estimate that only 20% of rooftop space in the U.S. is suitable for solar. So, you know, a lot of people rent their homes, a lot of people don't have the proper credit scores to go solar, or they have structural issues with their roof, shading issues. We work with our friends, solar developers, who tell us that, you know, most of the people that want to go solar with them, they have to turn down.
The startup was founded by a team led by Yale dropout Billy Parrish, who decided to pair up solar financing with the crowdfunding idea, which has literally launched hundreds of millions of dollars worth of entrepreneurial projects through sites like Kickstarter. Solar Mosaic was founded a bit over 18 months ago and was funded by Spring Ventures Venture Capital and a group of anonymous angel investors. One of these first investors termed the phrase clean web to describe the company because of its melding of online startup smarts and clean tech credentials. Mosaic's first five projects were not for profit, so the individual investors were putting in their money purely to get their initial investment back. And the first five buildings the company chose to install crowdfunded solar on in its initial beta phase were all themselves charity or community organizations, where the savings the solar installation can deliver can really add up, provided it's sunny, of course. In fact, one of the projects on a Vincent de Paul building in Alameda County just reported that in its first month, the solar Mosaic installation saved $1,800 in electricity bills. Last week, Mosaic funded a sixth project, also on a non-profit basis, at the offices of the NGO Youth Employment Partnership, which is Oakland's largest youth employment training academy.
Basically, the way that they worked is over 400 people put in varying amounts of money, anywhere from $25 to $25,000 into these projects, and it was all on a zero interest model. So all of these people will be getting their money back as the solar pays back. But, you know, we think once people start seeing the check come back and understand that, wow, I created solar and I'm getting my money back, they'll be excited to put more money in.
The site works that you can log on, check out a project, and see whether you want to put some money towards it. Solar Mosaic just picked up a grant from the US Department of Energy and is currently in a quiet period, during which they hope to get the regulatory approval from the Securities and Exchange Commission to open up crowdfunded solar for profit, where investors will get back their initial sum plus a percentage return. But the wait for approval is proving a little longer than the company first expected. But it's not only in the US where this kind of clean web innovation is hoping to open up the renewable energy industry to more investors. At the vast EU PVSEC trade show last week in Frankfurt, in the current centre of the solar world, Germany, Milk the Sun is introducing an online platform where investors looking for a good rate of return can purchase a solar installation, just like making a property investment. The challenge that founder Berlin entrepreneur Felix Krauser faces is convincing an industry that is used to working with brokers and engineers to conduct the due diligence incorporating a wide range of factors like the type of installation, the panels used, the site and weather patterns, and of course, just how much cash the solar array can generate through feeding electricity back into the grid.
It's still a standardized installation. I mean, I've got certain parameters that vary, but there aren't that many. Like going back to property, there are so many things that might change. I mean, the district you're living in might become extremely fashionable or vice versa. With solar, I've got like a certain angle facing the sun. I know the region I'm at, and I know the sunshine that I will have over a 20-year average.
Krauser believes that providing this type of transparency to an industry that isn't as intuitive a purchase as, say, property is to a lot of investors, that more funds can flow into solar, which is good for green energy, good for carbon emissions, and of course will generate commissions for Milk the Sun through sales on the site. Krauser reports that a number of deals are currently undergoing third-party due diligence, and that solar industry veterans are becoming less skeptical about the opportunities about trading installations online. A recent McKinsey & Company report predicted that the solar industry could be as big as between 400 and 600 gigawatts by 2020, which would mean as much power as about 100 large nuclear power plants. That's also a big window of opportunity for clean web entrepreneurs on both sides of the Atlantic. For Monocle in Frankfurt and San Francisco, I'm Jonathan Gifford.
From solar power to eco-friendly boats. That's up next after the break.
The danger for small entrepreneurial businesses is that they often build the management team around themselves. You need a strong team to adapt to new market environments and challenges. That was Bernard Ruger, our industrial entrepreneur, quoted from the Pictet report. Pictet, experts in wealth management.
Now, the summer's yachting season may be behind us, but the industry is busily trying to sell new models for next year. Despite the rough economic seas in today's market, some boat builders have managed to steer a course towards profitability. One of these is Austria's Frauscher. Family-run for 80 years, its slick motorboats for day cruising are made on a lake in Austria's mountains, but sold worldwide. At the Genoa Boat Show, Monocle correspondent Ivan Carvello spoke to owner Michael Frauscher about how the company has managed to stay ahead of the pack by going green and by taking a page from the auto industry when it comes to manufacturing.
My grandpa started the company. I'm the third generation now. We always built boats for elegant, sophisticated people who wanted to use it as a toy, and this toy had to be very elegant and sporty and classy. This was the start, and still our business, what we do for our customers.
So what's it like to run a family-run company in this kind of an industry?
We have workers where their fathers was with my father working together. In fact, they went to the same school, so I did with the son. So it's a mixture between this classical, typical boat builder, craftsman, and a very high-skilled engineer. And it's the main topic for me in my job to be the moderator of this, to get those ideas together.
Now, during the economic crisis, a lot of boatyards have been having problems, but I see Frauscher introduced another model this year. You've had a very long line of success. Just explain what's behind this success.
Family companies have a longer and stronger target to achieve their goals. It's not all about money. So if there are some years where we don't make much money, we still are focused to the success, which means to leave a footprint in the yachting industry, in the history of yachting. To do a nice and quality boat, you have to be very well organized. And this is a thing which is typical Austrian, I hope. Sometimes we say the Austrian is the perfect mixture between the Italians and the Germans. So hopefully we have the Italian style and the German organization. And this is the main thing which makes our success. We just opened a new factory. We are in this new factory now since 3 weeks. So probably we're the only company today which is really going forward instead of being frightened and scared. And the customer feels this. Very interesting for our companies that we work together with Porsche Consulting now since 2 years, because for moving the new factory, it was clear to start not with the old system, but create a new system of producing before, and which means lean manufacturing. This is a hard process to achieve this, but then we saved a lot of money, because just-in-time production makes at the end that you don't have to pay for stock. Quality is much higher, and also boats are produced much faster and more individual.
Now, in the boating industry, there's been a lot of criticism about the fact that it's very behind in terms of being sustainable, power boats, pleasure boats. How would you respond to that?
Austria is a very green country because of landscape and political reasons. So we are trained to think about this. We are more or less the inventor of electric-driven boats. Frauscher did the first hybrid for power boats, for pleasure power boats, and also the first hydrogen vehicle in the world anyway. You may today buy a hydrogen boat here at the Frauscher stand. You get it, it's governmentally approved, and it's fully working. The only point is that it's quite expensive.
So how is it during this economic climate that's very difficult? Have you been able to sell a lot of boats?
It was not a big down slow at the end, because the customer we target is not really too much scared of the economic crisis. If you do the very best, very sophisticated product to a reasonable price, you always will find customers. Of course, we went more international than we have been before. We sell now boats all over the world, so we sell 2 to Australia, 3 to Saudi, 1 to Beirut, everywhere in the world, some to Sweden. For creating the best boat, we look at how our customer is living, look at their houses, and you see it's all clean and clear design. We do the same on the boat. The design has to be spectacular, but it has to be reduced. I don't like boats where too many fittings are mounted, because if you make it clear, simple, and reduced, you don't have too many stuff on the boat, because a thing which is not there cannot break. I'm very proud that Porsche wrote in his car magazine that Porsche on water is the same like Porsche on land. And if you look at the history of Porsche, this is really spectacular, and I hope and I dream that we really will be Porsche on water.
That was Monocle's Milan correspondent at the Genoa Boat Show. Now, on to our next guest, Martin Franklin, who gave up a top job at Procter & Gamble to set up shop solo. He took a leap and left a salary and security to found menswear brand Foxall in London's Covent Garden. So, what's it like going from a career working for one of the world's largest multinationals to managing a small store? Monocle's Ben Jay went down to the new shop, Foxall, to find out.
I worked for Procter & Gamble for almost 13 years, principally in brand management and marketing, and spent a lot of that time working on the Vidal Sassoon business for 11, 12 years of that time, and really specialized in brand design and product development, and had the opportunity to work with the Sassoon creative team to develop new, essentially a whole new business model for the Sassoon business in the professional arena, which included coloring line, shampoo, conditioning, styling line, and a whole business model to support that business. So it was, although it was obviously classical FMCG in some respects, there was a really great creative dimension to it as well, working with the Sassoon team, you know, I think are the most talented creatives in the, you know, in the hair industry. And that was sort of the jumping off point to potentially want to work in an arena that was maybe a little bit more creative than a classical FMCG business.
So what made you want to leave there and turn to this? I mean, obviously you're not selling hair products right now.
No, we probably won't be for a little while. But what I realized is that I've always wanted to have my own brand and start my own business. And P&G kept me very challenged and motivated for a long time. And, you know, they allowed me to see the world and work with some brilliant people. And this just became the logical jumping off point, I think, for me to essentially have the confidence to feel like, okay, I know how to pull a brand together and develop it and nurture it, you know, in the early phases, because that's almost essentially what I did with the Sassoon business. And it just felt like now was the time. And the inspiration for fashion really came through my own personal experience of the, you know, of my own wardrobe, my own clothing interests, and starting to see some gaps in the market and thinking, well, you know, that's, I've always been inspired by entrepreneurs who've just seen that gap and gone after them themselves. And I figured out that's what I need to do. I need to see a gap for my need, because I'm sure I'm not the only one that's experiencing it, and go out and exploit that. And that's essentially what Foxall is aiming to do.
You know, how did you market yourself in such a large, vast market?
From a marketing point of view, we've really started with the people that we know. Because it's been a couple of years in development, there have been a lot of people that I've engaged with and involved and networked with to consult and to give input and we've researched it a lot. And those are the people that have some kind of sense of ownership or affinity or enthusiasm for what we're doing. And that felt like, that I think is the most logical place to start, is to start building that core group of people who've been on your journey with you, to start to become your most loyal customers. And they understand what you've been through. They know how much work's gone into all of the product development. So they have immediately become our most loyal customers to start with. We're really trying to leverage the store as a piece of real estate. And I think for a brand new brand, to have a store from the very first day is a huge asset that we really want to leverage. So we've been quite event-driven for the first, 6-9 months, and we're using every opportunity to bring people into store, to create some theater in store, to partner with some other, allied appropriate brands that, there's a shared interest with, and really to try and create some excitement in store. And from my point of view, we're leveraging our biggest asset, which is our retail space on a prime street in the middle of London's busiest shopping area. So that's our focus for right now.
And just finally, for other people who perhaps would like to change their career or are looking to, start their own business, what advice would you give them?
I think number one is really know what you want to do, like have a clear idea of, have a vision. But you have to have a vision, I think. You really have to have a vision of what you'd like to go out and do. And I think that vision needs to be tied to a really clear identification of a need. I think you really need to have a sense that there is an unmet need out there that, that your vision can really help to deliver. I think putting those two things together is, and that all has to happen in your head, I think. You know, you've got to have that idea and inspiration. And then I think you've got to back that up with some research and some quite, you know, some quite thorough analysis of what the market, you know, needs or is missing or could do with more of. And so I think those two things have to happen first. And then I think you've just got to get out there and do it. I mean, there have been times on, you know, putting Foxhole together where I've stepped back and I kind of think, you know, you step back and you think, wow, you know, am I crazy to be doing this? But you realize you've dived so far in already that there's no turning back. You've just got to keep going. And I think you've just got to take the leap and go and do it and follow it through to the end. You know, and I think once you've started, you kind of, it inspires you when you have the first little step. You know, for me, it was a big thing when we'd got the trademark for the UK. I felt like, okay, well, we own this name, now we can move forward. And then to develop the logo and then develop the icon. And then every little step builds, you know, one step further towards your vision. As those things build up, you gradually start to see the picture of your vision developing. And then it just takes, you know, it's the grunt work to then get it out there to, you know, to realize and open on that first day.
That was Foxhole founder Martin Franklin speaking to Monocle's Ben Jay. Venture capitalist Tony Chan had a question. What makes entrepreneurs tick? And is there any way to measure this? He took an unconventional approach to tackle the problem. He developed the Entrepreneurial Aptitude Test and interviewed hundreds of entrepreneurs and business leaders around the world. The results form the basis and the title of his new book, Hearts, Smarts, Guts and Luck. Chan and his co-authors are confident that every entrepreneur is dominated by one of those traits. Tony stopped by Midori House to tell us more.
We decided to write it almost by accident. As venture capitalists, day by day, we really have a job of being talent spotters more than investors. And seeing so many people come through, we decided about 3 years ago just to start videoing them. And what was interesting was that we started noticing patterns, and probably about 2 years ago, tried structuring those patterns and trying to determine what self-awareness traits really drove entrepreneurship. And they are the title of the book, Heart, Smarts, Guts, and Luck.
So how did you divide them into these four categories? And how did you take notice of what they were when you were watching the videos and when you were speaking with them?
We looked across numerous things: drive, passion, purpose, humility. And it became clear that we could bucket these in multiple ways, but we wanted to get something that was very intuitive, very memorable. And so the Heart, Smarts, Guts, and Luck was a useful framing. And if you look at the test, you'll see several adjectives are associated with each of those traits.
So let's go through the four of them. So heart. Tell us some entrepreneurs who kind of embody this heart.
Well, first, Daniel, I think entrepreneurs in general, founders as a category, represent 60% of them are heart-driven. And an interesting pattern we noticed in doing the research was that people tend to be dominant in one or two traits. You need all four, but people tend to be dominant in one or two. So if you look across the board of entrepreneurs, first, I myself am a heart, smarts driven person, but I think you'll find that there are just numerous people in the U.S. There's a gentleman, Steve Vells, who founded Chipotle, which is a great, you know, fast casual Mexican grill chain. And he's a very heart-driven entrepreneur and someone that just gets so passionate about every component of their business that, you know, what size of the onion should be chopped, what's the perfect balance of ingredients. And they really start from that soulful place, is representative of a heart-driven entrepreneur.
And now from heart to smart, what's an example of someone who's kind of embodied by smarts?
Well, obviously someone like Warren Buffett, who has incredible pattern recognition, and in general great investors have a strong pattern recognition, and great entrepreneurs. But of all the four traits of the heart, smarts, guts, and luck, the smart side came out only about 10% in dominance in our survey population of 500 plus entrepreneurs. The crux of smarts is that two things. One, it's a combination of different types of smarts. It's book IQ smarts, it's creative smarts, it's street smarts, and people smarts. But it's fundamentally about pattern recognition. Can you see different patterns? Can you be an inductive reasoner?
And is that something that's more commonly found in specific industries, do you think? Did you measure that at different industries, or was it
we didn't look at gender or industry as much for that. In fact, one of the core things we tried to do is not make this just another U.S.-centric West Coast Silicon Valley study. Pattern recognition is critical across all these industries. When we looked at great chefs, people like Alice Waters or the Momofuku guys or someone like Steve Ells, you know, there's pattern recognition that just comes from doing things over and over that eventually just become innate and intuitive.
And now guts.
Guts is all about that, you know, that propensity to action. We all know people that just care much more about doing than overthinking. And so much about business, as we saw an interesting factoid as an aside, 70% of great businesses, businesses that had a sale or an IPO or an exit, did not start with a business plan. And the guts-driven people are the people that just Nike it. Just start by doing it. Let's just feel. And they're just compelled to action. The second great characteristic of someone that's guts-driven is resilience. Great resilience. A UK-based example would be someone like Richard Branson. I think he once said that the best way to become a multimillionaire is start off as a billionaire and then start an airline. And so I think that that guts to try something new and always be moving forward and pushing yourself and having great resilience.
And now luck. This is something that all entrepreneurs kind of would probably agree that had a lot to do with how they got where they are. Tell us about this.
Well, I think most entrepreneurs and most people, when they talk on luck, they take the conventional definition of luck, the connotations of chance and probability and good fortune. However, luck we saw was correlated. It is true those entrepreneurs, myself included, have had good fortune put on them. But what you see is that the luck dominant, and it was 25% of founders, by the way, were luck dominant, they really have a certain attitude. And that attitude is defined by three qualities: humility, intellectual curiosity, and optimism. I mean, the luck dominant just have this great ability to think about every reason why something might work before thinking about a single reason why it might not. And Tony Hsieh of Zappos is a great example of someone that just leads with a very positive and luck dominant attitude. And in many cases, sometimes is quite introverted in his leadership style, just having that humility to learn from people. And people with those three qualities, Daniel, really just have luck come to them more often, and also have the capacity to take advantage of the luck when it does arrive.
And self-awareness, I mean, this all has to do with kind of people looking inside themselves and figuring out which one of these four they're dominated by. Why do you think this movement of self-awareness is so important?
Well, I think it's human nature to not be self-aware. It's human nature to show off your good side. It's human nature in playing sports to show off your forehand and not your backhand. And self-awareness starts by understanding what your superhuman strength is relative to others and what your kryptonite is. And it's very, very hard to try to be intellectually honest about where your weaknesses are. Self-awareness, more than any other factor as a whole, we believe, drives greater success.
That was venture capitalist and author Tony Chan. We'll be back with our weekly branding chat right after this short break.
Entrepreneurs make new money. We protect it until it becomes old money. Pictet, experts in wealth management since 1805.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. While many wristwatch companies cultivate the glamour and heritage of aviation, few go as far as Helsinki-based manufacturer Demotu. Headquartered at the Helsinki-Malmi Airport, one of the oldest in Europe, their building sits squarely next to the airport's snow-covered hangar. After each timepiece is built and polished, it takes only a few steps out of the door before it's on a plane and tested in flight. Finnish entrepreneur Mats Wolontis is on the board of Demotu, and he popped by Midori House with a few watches to speak to our Adrian Craddock.
It's what we call a pilot instrument. It's handmade for sort of serious aviation-interested people or people interested in aviation as such. The new thing about this is that it has a fully functional built-in G-meter, where you can measure the G-force as you do in, you know, Formula Ones or in aeroplanes.
So we've got one on the table here. It's quite large. It's a real kind of instrument, as you say that word. I mean, it's not kind of a toy, is it?
It's absolutely not a toy. It looks like a pilot instrument. Actually, our finder is a professional pilot. So this is pretty much based on the look and feel of what you can have inside a cockpit. Also, the sort of the way we make these, we test them, we actually take each and every watch on a flight. And you can see that it has holes, the actual watch, so you can screw it onto the cockpit and actually follow the G-force whilst you fly. And they are all numbered, and if you happen to buy one, if you want to come and pick it up from Finland, we'll take you on a flight, so you can test it yourself.
Can you show me kind of how it works? You were showing me a bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's simple. You have a sort of normal watch here where you can see the time, and then you have quite a big measure of G-force from 0 to 11. The pressure you feel when you drive a car fastly and turn rapidly to the right or left, you are pushed against the door, basically. And the more you are pushed, the higher the G-force is.
So
a couple of G-force is what the normal person would experience in a car. Then when you go up above 4, 5, 6, then we're talking probably Formula One, and then aeroplanes, you go even higher than that.
It's quite responsive, this little meter, isn't it?
It works, and as I said, we test every single one, so this is really a pilot instrument. This is tested beside the actual G-meter in the plane.
Mm-hmm. So give it a shake. You're showing me, you know, even when you shake it, it can pick it up.
So now I shook it quite hard. It got to 2G. Now I shook it really as much as I can, and it got a bit above 4G.
Okay.
And then just reset it, and that's it, back on standby.
You hear a lot about the Swiss watchmaking industry and perhaps Japan. Mm. Finland, I mean, it doesn't really come up that much when it comes to watchmaking. Is this a new industry in Finland, or does Finland have quite a rich tradition in this kind of thing?
It is a new thing in Finland. We have a few. You might have heard of Sarpaneva. He's a very famous guy. He makes just a handful of watches a year, which he sells for, I don't know, 50,000 or 500,000 euros each. We know that Switzerland is really the watch country of the world, but at the same time, if you look clearly or carefully, it says that manufacturer at Helsinki Malmi Airport. So our office is actually at an airport hangar. So we're very proud of the Finnish heritage. I mean, these are hardcore watches. They have to withstand minus 30 to plus 30 degrees, and we're fine with that.
I find it very interesting that the aesthetic of this watch is aviation, but also it's fantastic, this idea that everything surrounding this watch incorporates this brand image. It's produced in an airport hangar. Mm. It comes in this kind of stainless steel, almost flight case. Yes. Is that kind of important? You think, you know, if you're going to go with a brand, you've really got to go all out.
I must say that even though I'm involved myself, we're really proud about the brand, because we are still a startup company with just a handful of people. We make, you know, one watch and then another watch, basically. But the thinking and the development of this seriously very young brand is really good. It looks very good. It's well thought through. And as you said, the devil is in the detail, and I think we've done a good job there.
So what now? Are you going to expand into different models? Are you going to focus on this, make it your signature, or what are your plans from now?
The plans are, yes, we're going to make a move into different models. There will be one where the sort of watch is a bigger face. Next year, we'll have a model with an altimeter, as said. We will have special editions made of gold, for instance, and then we have some really interesting, just maybe one or two or three watches that will be made of metal from some famous planes from the Second World War that have been found in the lakes of Finland or somewhere else in Europe and dug up. So there will be really exciting sort of super special series around this. These were Finnish planes shot down by Russians during the Second World War, and they were found in a lake, I can't say, maybe 30, 40 years later. Mm-hmm. And now we have managed to get some of that metal which fits our watch frame. So we're going to make a few numbered series, limited edition, around that metal and that plane.
It seems like that side of watchmaking is becoming quite lucrative as well. I mean, we've seen over the last few years pieces of metal from the Titanic and stuff like that, very kind of niche historic metals being used on watches. Do you think that's the future in this industry?
I think there will be some editions of that, but obviously this will be just a handful of watches. So there will always be those super special series, but for us that's more something to sort of maybe stretch the brand a bit and may make something exciting. But clearly the main focus is on the standard watches that we're going to produce, if you can call them standard watches.
The interesting thing with this, looking through the pamphlet, is it looks amazing, really sleek kind of design throughout the pamphlet. The whole branding is really like quite impressive. But I imagine that you guys, you know, you're not Rolex, so I imagine you wouldn't have the same resources to throw at this kind of branding. How have you achieved this? Is it just to do with smart people?
I think it's a combination, but I mean, the founder is a professional pilot, so it's his passion. And obviously then he met people who are in the watch industry and these guys together. So it all comes up from putting together the right people, having the same passion, sharing the same passion. And then they just started working on this idea. I can't even remember who came up with the let's put the first G meter into any wristwatch anywhere. Mm-hmm. But that's where it all originated. And then extensive work on the branding, as you said. And here we are. Resource is very limited. We're talking a few people. Mm-hmm. But hey, if you believe in it, you just go for it.
That was Mats Wolontis from Demotu Watches with Adrian Craddock. Time for our weekly branding chat now, where our colleagues at Wink Creative mull over a branding problem and a solution. This week we chatted Le Creuset with Natalie Jones and Adam Thompson.
Le Creuset has been around since 1925 in France. It actually means melting pot. The first product Le Creuset launched was actually a French oven, the Cocotte. Since then, I think it very much feels like a heritage brand. You know, this is a stay on the stove piece. You feel like your mum had it, I want it, and I hope to have my children have one as well. The first publicity campaign was around the war and actually got closed in the war because it got occupied by the German forces. So it got closed and then it reopened again. And since then it's been strong. It's now sold in 60 countries.
And we should say that they have a niche in a sense that they have cultivated a way of cooking as well. It's this cast iron pots and their sort of iconic colour is orange, and they do blue and other colours now. But it's a way of cooking slowly, of this sort of very homely, cosy, sort of fulfilling way of cooking. Do you think that that marks it out, and do you think it is capitalising on that enough, Adam?
I think that the issue that we see is that, as you say, there is almost a different school of cooking that they promote, and it's very much about kind of cooks as opposed to chefs, and it's very much about home as opposed to restaurant. So it's very much a kind of in-home, cosy brand. But then, at the same time, they also have part of their product offer is also a kind of more modern, you know, non-stick pans and kind of kitchen utensils side of things. So there is this almost juxtaposition of these two different things going on.
What's interesting about this brand is that it used to kind of be very at the forefront of trends. It first sold into Selfridges in 1961. And with the launch of its first griddle pan, it kind of was seen as the future of health cooking. So people looked at Le Creuset as this kind of trend-setting brand, whereas this has been lost now, I think. So it's interesting, I think we'll discuss in a minute, how maybe they could kind of capture that essence again.
In terms of, you know, the colour, the sort of association of the brand, do you think that they're doing well with their sort of iconography, with their branding from an aesthetic point of view? It seems quite strong.
I think from a kind of colour perspective, obviously Le Creuset has this wonderful association with orange. But in terms of how that is used, their website is not very good at all, to be honest, and probably just needs an entire overhaul, but it's not used very well there. It should be used more as an accent. And I think the same in terms of the retail experience. It feels like a kind of bombardment of orange when you go into the store.
So too much orange and not enough orange?
Well, yes.
Tricky. Do you think they could cultivate more of a sense of the heritage whilst forging ahead and being a trendsetter? I love Le Creuset because, for instance, my knob broke the other day and I went and bought a new one, and the woman in the Le Creuset shop was so helpful, and she was so nurturing about the pan I bought 10 years ago. And it felt like, you know, they were doing something along the lines of Globetrotter or, you know, Barber, those really wonderful, or Hermes, where you can fix your things and you can keep them in the family. Maybe they should cultivate, you know, that philosophy more as part of the brand. What do you think, Natalie?
Yeah, I think they do need to sort of draw on the heritage and the values of the brand. I mean, in store, their window display, for example, is not embracing heritage. And there's so many things you can do with that. You could collaborate with a beautiful cupboard makers, for example, kitchen cupboard makers, where you know, the artisanal craft is really coming through. Falcon are doing great things. That's another enamel brand. And they've just completely relaunched their brand with a really contemporary age, fantastic photography on their website. So that's a brand that's doing it really well.
So should we do some quick fixes, how you'd really sort of apply a few Wink creative tenets of branding to this brand, just to see if we can guide it in the right direction? I know you've mentioned the in-store revamp, that the orange needs some serious thought. What else would you do to really bring it along?
French cooking lessons would be some, you know, a great idea online or in store. You know, the perfect bourguignon, for example, to be able to make that, really pull into that French heritage and feel that you can get some expertise in how to use your Le Creuset to make delicious food, basically, in the home.
In terms of other brands that they could emulate or even, you know, make a partnership with, who do you think is really sort of a benchmark for branding in the kitchenware department?
Well, Mouviel, I mean, the online website isn't amazing, but what they do have is a feeling of a story and a narrative, which I think Le Creuset could benefit from. Jeweler and KitchenAid are also good examples of brands that have that long-standing, convincing authority that, you know, consumers buy into, but they've kind of modernised it, and chefs as well as cooks in the home buy into the brand. So they've kind of got a really good hold on the market, I think.
And if I could add to that, I think Staub have, I think a lot of what they've done has really been just getting their product on influential restaurant tables. So you get your dish delivered in the Staub pot, and I think that has a real kind of impact. And Le Creuset are obviously missing out on that a little bit. So there's certainly restaurants that we could recommend for them to partner with on that front.
And what about Joseph?
Yeah, well, they're a good contemporary brand, and they kind of look at ergonomics and usability as well. So, you know, sometimes Le Creuset talk about themselves as being innovative and talking about handles and that kind of thing. And I'd say Joseph just do it a bit better.
And that was Natalie Jones and Adam Thompson from Wink Creative talking Le Creuset in Branding Corner. And that's all we have time for this week. This show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our studio manager is Holly Fisher. And I'm Sophie Grove. Please feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or feedback, and you can reach me at sgr@monocle.com and our producer Daniel at dg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more inspiring news and views from entrepreneurs all around the world.